From Texas to Illinois, South Dakota to Maine, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, draconian shutdown policies aimed at stemming the COVID-19 pandemic have prompted a recall effort against California Governor Gavin Newsom. Paul Preston from Red State Radio is here with details. 2021 has gotten off to a fast political start with two U.S. Senate seats in Georgia decided and results of the presidential election certified by Congress. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to offer his analysis on why the GOP lost those two U.S. Senate runoff elections in Georgia. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court tilted the presidential election playing field to Joe Biden. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. An effort to recall California Governor Gavin Newsom is gaining steam in the wake of his harsh shutdown policies, supposedly to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. Paul Preston is host of Agenda 21 Radio on Red State Radio, and he spearheads the movement for a new California state. He joins us now to discuss the recall. Paul, welcome to American Radio Journal. Paul, before we talk specifically about the recall effort, can you give our listeners, since they're all over the country, a sense of what's happening in California? It appears, even from Pennsylvania, where I am, where we've had a lot of draconian shutdowns, that California is even a step beyond that. What's happening?
Well, what's happening is you're seeing the collapse of the California state government being led by a dictator, really, is what you have. You have a monoparty system here. There's no true Republicans or Democrats any longer. They've eliminated the two-party system. You have a legislature that truly is mostly Democratic. About, if you take a look at the 120 legislators total, which is Assembly and House, you probably have that. There's probably 110 that are Democrat. So you don't really have a lot of Republicans. And it's just wiped out the system. And now, with the COVID situation, the governor, Gavin Newsom, has declared an emergency, and it just so happens, prior planning in 2015, they dropped the requirement in the Emergency Powers Act for the governor that he could only use his emergency powers for 30 days. Instead, they took that out of the law, and they did it deliberately in 2015, and then they said he could have power indefinitely or until the legislature says no. And, of course, the legislature, being a monoparty system, isn't going to say no. So you have a governor who's acting as a dictator.
One of the areas, though, that you have in California, Paul, that most other states don't, is the ability to recall your governor. And that would seem to me to be a lever that citizens still have. Tell us a bit about the recall effort. What is required and how is it going?
The last one that was done was with Gray Davis. It was successfully brought in. You know, of course, you better watch what you wish for, because when we recalled Gray Davis, we got Arnold Schwarzenegger. He turned out to be a complete socialist, complete with the whole destruction of the education, the complete finalization of destruction of the education system as we know it. Very negative about business, oddly enough. Just turned out to be a bad experience with him. And then that ushered in Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown was a governor prior to Jerry Brown, between the 70s and 80s and 2000s. Jerry Brown served 16 years as governor, and a radical environmentalist that he is, you can imagine what he did to business. So recalls have happened here before. There's been a couple of governors ever recalled in American history. And this particular recall, this is now on its fourth attempt to recall him. And this recall effort, as they say, is picking up steam. It's getting more money. The other part is that they have to get about a billion, three or four, I think, signatures. And part of the problem with the process is that you can only get three signatures per page of paper, and it has to be wetting, and it has to be within the boundaries of the margins that they have for the signature box. And if any part of your signature touches that box, they throw the whole thing out. All three signatures get thrown out. So they say they have about 800,000 signatures now, a little over 60% there, they say. again, they all have to be checked out still. So the likelihood of this going through is stronger now because they have been picking up money from very odd places, I might add, but they have been picking up money and steam because of everybody's anxious. Sort of a bigger problem than a lot of people realize. So if they get rid of Gavin Newsom, still left with the same government, the same bureaucracy, nothing has really changed. And I think no matter if he gets to be governor of California, he could never make a difference because the Constitution is so heavily weighted against anything but the monoparty system.
One of the solutions that you've proposed, and you're part of the movement for a new California state, is dividing California into two different states. Geographically, how would you do that? And politically, how do you get that done?
I look at everything, any way to divide the state up. And there's been over 220 attempts to divide California up since 1850. And we're the only one that's really legitimately moved forward. In fact, we're the only one that's moved forward legitimately since 1861 when West Virginia became a state. Looks like we're going to be a state very soon, actually. That's kind of what's happening. Looks like we're going to be a state real soon. So what's going to happen is that, or what happened to cause this, is that as we were drawing up the state and figuring out, well, you had this, you had that, and other ways to draw up the state or divide it up. It was three states, six states, five states. It was a mishmash of things, and none of it really made a lot of sense. So the only thing that made sense to us was that we divided up by population. How do we get from 20 million on one side and 20 million on the other and have an even Steven population? So we just played around with it, and I started adding up the numbers of people who lived in the urbanized areas of California. And I found out that between Sacramento, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, you have 20 million people. Well, the total population of California is 40 million. So I'm not a rocket scientist, but I can do it arithmetic. And I said, well, there's our population parity base, urban versus rural. And so I just based upon the population numbers of people, one person, one vote. If you want to look at it that way, okay, well, you've got 20 million in urbanized California and 20 million in ruralized California. So there's our division. California, the rest of California will be, or the remainder anyway, will be the areas of Los Angeles and San Francisco and Sacramento. That's it for California. And for us, 90% of the landmass from the Oregon border all the way to Mexico is New California.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye on that. It would be fascinating. As you've mentioned, it's been over 100 years since it's happened. We have been talking with Paul Preston. He is host of Agenda 21 Radio on Red State Radio. Also, he spearheads Movement for a New California State. Paul, tell us where folks can go to learn more about New California State, and also where can they hear you on the radio?
Every morning from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific, or 9 to 12 Eastern, I'm on Red State Talk Radio. We have it out of Washington, D.C. That's where our studios are. I have a studio over here in California, of course. And you can also check out the website, a21r.com. That's A as in Adam, numbers 2 and 1, R.com. And, of course, the big one is newcaliforniastate.com.
Paul Preston from Agenda 21 Radio. Paul, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a new year, and Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here to talk about the fact that, well, the year has gotten off to a very fast political start. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Scott, we had the two runoff elections for U.S. Senate seats in Georgia. Control of the United States Senate hinged in the balance. We, of course, know what happened, but can you give us your analysis of the race?
Number one, we knew that it was very, very tight race going into it. We thought that there was a lot of voters that had enthusiasm about showing up to the polls, but we always knew that the turnout would be lower than the general election. And in the end, the turnout in this race was, I think, pretty high, almost at 90%. I think it was at 89%. And it showed that there were a lot of voters that key demographics that put the Democrats over the top in two really, really close races. With David Perdue's race, it's only a 35,000 vote race and less than 1%. So So that's a very, very close one. And then when you look at the Warnock lead against Kelly Loeffler, obviously that's a little bit of a larger lead at 1.6%. But I do think that Warnock, his lead's insurmountable at that point. So we know that the Democrats are going to have a 50-50 Senate with the tiebreaker of former Senator, now Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. And that's going to mean things for the Senate in terms of the way that they consider different legislative proposals and also the way that they deal with our judicial system on nominations.
Looking at the Senate going forward here, Scott, since it is 50-50, you do have, well, at least one, to the degree there is a moderate senator left, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who has made statements, and we'll see whether or not he follows through, that some of these fundamental changes like packing the Supreme Court, eliminating the filibuster, things of that sort, he's not in favor of that type of radical change. Do you see that there might be other Democrats who would join him and say, look, you know, we have the majority, we'll operate within the framework we've always had, and we can still get things done? Or are they going to go for radical change real quick?
Well, if it is any of them, it's usually the ones that have been in government longer and have experienced the swing back and forth between which majority holds the leadership. And one thing that I think the Democrats will start out by doing is looking to get a budget passed so that they can use budget reconciliation on one of the top agenda items that Joe Biden wants to advance during his presidency. And so there's a couple of different bills that I think could be looked at in the reconciliation form, and then how far do the Democrats change the rules to basically jam through what they want to do on a low number of votes. If the parliamentarian rule seems to be corrosive and nuclear to the legislative package so that it's not eligible to be reconciled, then I think the Democrats would consider drastic changes to the filibuster on the legislative filibuster. And so anyways, I think that the 50-50 Senate, these Georgia races, it was tough to, it looks like, lose both of them. But we need to be prepared for what it means when Democrats have unified government and what role the minority party has in that situation.
Looking across the rotunda at the House of Representatives, Scott, Nancy Pelosi, reelected speaker, very, very narrow margin. They only have, what, about a 6 or 7 seat majority there. And we all know that the first midterm of a new president is usually a disaster for that president's party in Congress. So do you see that there would be a certain element in the House that would resist these radical changes out of fear of losing their seats in 2022?
I think almost all of them are going to go along with it because this is now the party of AOC and Nancy Pelosi, and they ideologically push things. I think Pelosi's position as speaker is to get a deal, but AOC's position is to make the bill progressive and try to, you know, enact part of the Democrats' Green New Deal type agenda. So we should be looking for Democrats to really push the ball forward on some of these issues. That includes the big H.R. 1 For the People Act, the way that speech is considered with political contributions and whether or not you can even talk directly with a member of Congress. Those issues are fundamental to the Constitution surrounding speech, but imagine if you're a $5 donor to a candidate and then they tell you that you can't go talk to them. I mean, that's obviously a fundamental shift in the way that there's politics and money.
Let's shift gears here for just a minute or so, Scott. Congress did meet in joint session here, actually on the early morning hours of the 7th of January. They performed their duty to certify the votes of the Electoral College. Is that the end now of the presidential election process? Are we now cleared to move forward to Inauguration Day?
Yeah, I think so. The president did say that there would be a peaceful transfer of power, and I think that he recognizes that there were a lot of people that are unhappy about the election results. There's other people that voted and have uncertainty on what their vote actually counted toward. And then there's other people that firmly think that the decisions that Congress made were in line and there were very many lawsuits considered, and none of those were accepted by the Department of Justice or the Attorney General.
It certainly has been a consequential start to 2021, and as the year progresses, we will keep track of everything that happens in Washington, D.C. We will do so with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we've got over 500,000 members that are working with us to advance economic liberty in America. And if you're interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lumen.
The GOP lost two U.S. Senate runoff elections in Georgia, and as a result, Democrats will now control the upper chamber. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine offers his analysis.
Back when he was running for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump promised, or perhaps warned, Republican voters that if he was elected, they would become so sick and tired of winning. In Georgia, at least, that appears to be true. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at the results of those two Georgia Senate runoff races on Tuesday, both of which were won narrowly by the Democratic candidates. And those results got overshadowed, understandably, by some of the just bizarre and chaotic and frankly, somewhat embarrassing events that took place in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday of this week. But in the long run, I think it's probably clear that the Georgia Senate results, which give the Democratic Party a majority in the Senate and thus a majority in all of Congress, those results are probably the more significant thing that happened this week, even if it's, you know, not the thing that was the big spectacle or caught everybody's attention. The Democratic candidates in Georgia, Raphael Warnock, a pastor, and John Ossoff, a political activist and journalist, appear to have narrowly won those two runoff elections on Tuesday night. And as long as those results are confirmed the way they appear now, that would leave the Senate evenly divided between the two parties. And that means that incoming Vice President Kamala Harris will be the tie-breaking vote for Democrats. Combined with the results of November's election, that, of course, means that when Trump leaves office in 2 weeks, Democrats will have full control of the federal government. They will have the White House and both chambers of Congress. What that also means is that in the span of 2 months, President Donald Trump has presided over 3 statewide losses in Georgia, a state that hadn't gone to Democrats in a presidential contest since 1992 and that hadn't elected a Democrat to the Senate since 2000. Now, Georgia has always been kind of a weak point in the Republicans' big southern wall there, and it's still too soon to say whether this is evidence of a big political realignment in Georgia, the sort of thing that Democrats have been promising was coming for years, or whether this is just a one-off rejection of Trump and the Republican Party. Either way, these results are a big deal. And there's really two consequences here, one significant thing that it means for Republicans and one that it means for Democrats. This is, on the Republican side, I think exactly what the party deserves, quite frankly, after 4 years of not just tolerating, but even embracing Trump's increasingly authoritarian, spendthrift, and just completely uninformed governing ways. It's the outcome that the party probably deserves for rallying around a man who was impeached and defeated at the ballot box, and it's what they should get for following Trump down this crazy rabbit hole of conspiracy theories that he's been participating in since the election in particular. Instead of rejecting him as a failed president and a losing president and moving in a different direction. The best thing that could come out of Tuesday's results for Republicans is this long overdue reckoning with the Trumpist element within the party. And already the recriminations are beginning, and I'm sure more will come in the days and weeks and months ahead. But easily the worst thing to come out of Tuesday's runoff is what it means for the federal government, what it means for the rest of America that will now have to pay the price of Republicans losing these very winnable elections. There's going to be unified control of government that Democrats are going to get to enjoy now for at least the next 2 years. And when one party controls both halves of Congress and the White House, the result is almost never a reduction in the size or the cost of government. In the short term, The slim Democratic majority in the Senate means that President-elect Joe Biden will be able to be much more aggressive about his executive branch appointments. Biden was reportedly waiting to announce some of his cabinet picks until after the Georgia elections. Now, that could be one of two things. It could either indicate that the nominee he was going to pick would be different if Republicans had a Senate majority versus if Democrats did, or it could have been nothing more than a simple strategic maneuver to avoid giving Republicans something to campaign on in Georgia, basically the opposite of what Trump and people like Josh Hawley did by giving the Democrats additional fuel for their fire with all these post-election shenanigans. Biden staying quiet has worked for him throughout all of 2020, and it seems like it may have worked again here in early 2021. The other thing that a slim Democratic majority in the Senate means is that Biden will get judicial appointments, and that means that all the Republicans who have justified so much of Trump's bad behavior because they liked that he was packing the federal courts with conservative jurists, well, now they're going to have to watch Biden and Harris steer the federal judiciary in a very different direction. It also means that we'll likely see another COVID-19 relief bill passed in the early days of the Biden administration. That means one that will probably be loaded up with billions of dollars for state and local governments. That's an unnecessary bailout that Senate Republicans have successfully and correctly blocked for most of last year. But now that sort of package is going to be the top priority as Senate Majority Leader, or likely future Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer confirmed on Wednesday during a press conference. In the longer term, that slim Democratic majority in the Senate has slightly murkier implications for policymaking. There is a few other factors to consider here, right? There's the filibuster. There's the presence of Senator Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia, but a very conservative Democrat. There's also the fact that Democrats will already be looking ahead to 2022, where they have to defend seats in places like Arizona and New Hampshire. All of that is likely to limit some of Biden's aspirations. On the other hand, of course, simply controlling the committees and determining what gets to the floor in the Senate is a big deal, too. Schumer being the majority leader instead of Mitch McConnell obviously changes just the basic functionings of how the Senate will operate and shifts things in a direction that's more favorable to Joe Biden. In the end, what we're likely to see over the next 2 years, with Democrats now having full control of the federal government, is more spending, bigger government, and more liberal appointees to the executive branch and the federal courts. The results of Tuesday's runoff are likely to be more consequential, ultimately, in the long run, than the chaos that we saw at the Capitol on Wednesday. And what it means is that for those of us, like me, and I assume like many of you, who prefer limited government, who want to see limitations placed on what the government does, and even scaling back the size and expense of the federal government, we are going to face two difficult years ahead. And for that, really, Republicans should take most of the blame. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the Georgia Senate elections, of all the chaos in D.C. this week at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
An activist Pennsylvania Supreme Court changed election law to benefit Joe Biden. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains how they did it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The presidential election of 2020 will go down as a pivotal test of whether or not our great constitutional republic experiment in liberty will survive. There are a few states that will serve as a front line in this critical battle for survival. Be it Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Nevada, or Arizona, the impact on our grand experiment will be profound. As a member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, recently reelected to a third term in a landslide, I've seen firsthand the overwhelming tilting of the scales of justice in the 2020 elections in my own state. I'm in the midst of this battle for survival for our republic. The undue influence by the executive branch and the judicial branches of government have been profound in Pennsylvania, virtually guaranteeing the debacle that has occurred in the 2020 election in the Keystone State. With the election results in for most states, the overturning of the tentative election results in Pennsylvania and two other states such as Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, or Wisconsin, which have seen similar allegations of inconsistencies and irregularities, would alter the election results and thereby reelect Donald J. Trump to a second term, since the Electoral College has already met, is unlikely, thereby setting up the constitutional challenge. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has been so biased in its actions relative to this election that it appears as if some justices on the court colluded with the DNC and the governor to influence the election. In September 2020, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court changed Act 77 of 2019 by allowing votes to arrive 3 days after election date and to permit drop boxes, both of which have been specifically precluded by Act 77. Even NPR wrote in its article that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court handed down several voting-related decisions Thursday that are likely to help Democrats this fall, and it did. The court extended the deadline for accepting mail-in ballots, will allow voters to submit their ballots through drop boxes, and remove the Green Party's candidate for president for the ballot. End of quote. These decisions were further exacerbated when the court further ruled just prior to the election that signatures on mail-in ballots could not be verified as a basis for disqualifying a vote. The conduct of one justice was so outrageous that I filed articles of impeachment, House Resolution 1044, against him for his alleged conduct. These charges include failing to abide by the canons of judicial ethics embodied in the Pennsylvania Code of Judicial Conduct in the League of Women Voters of Pennsylvania versus the Commonwealth, violating Article 4, Section 15 of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, violating Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States, exercising authority that is solely vested in the legislative branch under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, exercising authority that is solely vested in the legislative branch under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in the Wolf versus Scarnati case, failing to abide by the canons of judicial ethics embodied in the Pennsylvania Code of Judicial Conduct to disclose his potential bias in the parties of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party versus Wolf. Notwithstanding the judicial interference, the executive branch, particularly the Department of State, has been so horribly inept in its actions that election inconsistencies were rampant throughout Pennsylvania in the 2020 election. For instance, in Philadelphia, the Trump campaign went to court to allow election observers close-up observation of vote counting. But this legal victory happened on November 5th, 2 days after the election, and after much counting had already been done. Additionally, the counties were given such conflicting guidance from the Department of State relative to the election that uniformity of the election processing of ballots would be impossible to enforce. In the case of Barnett versus Montgomery County Board of Elections, one county actually has been accused of attempting to cure defective votes cast despite a court decision to the contrary. It turns out that similar guidance went out to multiple counties, particularly in more urban areas. Due to the rampant concerns of irregularities and inconsistencies, House Resolution 1032 was introduced prior to the election. It was since tabled, but is not being pursued with the governor to ensure that the past election's results fairly and accurately reflect the desires of the citizens of the Commonwealth in the most recent presidential election. Election fairness is important in reality, as well as with the perception of fairness. Our liberties and our system of government demand accountability, transparency, honesty, and how we select our leaders. The election of 2020 for our nation is our most important test of our fragile system of liberty, justice, and our basic freedoms that I have always sworn to support, defend, and uphold when I was a United States Marine and now as a representative in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Our nation is depending upon the states to exercise those constitutional prerogatives necessary to ensure that our elections fairly represent the will of the people and our great republic. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include KFHR-FM and KBET-AM in Las Vegas, Nevada, along with KRCK-FM in Palm Springs, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.